Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I hope you're well. So I did ask you a couple of times whether you'd let me know what some of your favourite episodes were. And I've had a few responses, so that's really good. And you can still carry on and send me some more. I thought I'd play you a few clips today from some previous podcasts. But I also had a couple of messages saying that one of the podcasts I did a couple of weeks back where I was just talking about my wham days and then just sharing some thoughts about thoughts and how we can reframe them. And I was really pleased that that landed with some people. Well, I got a really lovely message from someone who said, thanks for the podcast. Sometimes you'll say something small, something that may seem fairly inconsequential, but it will have a huge positive impact on my frame of mind. And I find myself agreeing with you out loud. Yes, Janie, I hear you. It's helped me immensely. I'll continue to listen. So that's just great, isn't it? Isn't that what it's all about? That's what we all want, isn't it? Those little light bulb moments. And that's why I think it's great that we do go over some of the same stuff again. But I've always found that for myself, if I rock up to an event and I hear a speaker who I've perhaps heard several times in the past, and of course they say a lot of the same shtick, don't they? Of course they do. But it lands differently because we're in a different place and we're more open, or we hear it differently, or even if it is something that we already know, we get it reinforced. So that's why I don't kind of apologise for repeating myself sometimes, which is just as well, I suppose, because, you know, there's lots of things I say a lot, okay? But maybe, you know, it will just land differently, or maybe there'll be somebody new who's coming in and hearing this stuff for the first time. So just a reminder that you can drop me a message and tell me some of the podcasts you've enjoyed in the past, maybe just a line from the podcast that landed with you, and I'll see if I can dig something out. We are going to be celebrating our 250th episode soon. I can't believe it. Incredible. And I was looking back and I realised that a few months back, about a year ago, I think it was, we celebrated our 1.1 million downloads, and I ran a few clips. So I thought I'll do the same thing again. I'm going to do a little rerun today of some clips, so you'll get to hear a few guests that you've heard before. So probably, but as I say, maybe some of the stuff will land. Just before I do that, let me just read you a little bit of this email that I received, because I thought this was very relatable to the kind of things a lot of people say within the Sober Club. So this email said, Janie, I have 83 days alcohol-free, big exclamation mark list. I don't have anyone to tell who understands the journey. And you always say on the podcast that people are free to email you. So here I am. I was a grey area drinker and don't identify with the word alcoholic at all. But as time goes on, I'm really thinking back over my drinking career and actually feeling a bit shocked at some situations I find myself in. Maybe they should have been my rock bottoms. A scary thought. Life since I removed alcohol has been utterly joyous. I'm so clear-headed, so positive, and so happy. The hardest thing is breaking the news to both people I know and also strangers. In the last 83 days, there have been a few embarrassing moments, to be honest. People are just so shocked when they ask, what would you like to drink? And you reply with, sparkling water, please. All heads turn in your direction, and a hideous silence falls among the gathering. It's unbearable. I'm still finding my footing, but I have no intention of drinking any more poison in my lifetime. Fantastic email. I think it really, really sums up how a lot of people feel. They're doing this thing, you know, they're a few months in, they know it's absolutely the right thing, they feel great, everything in their life is starting to change, they feel that positivity, they feel that sense of joy that they might not have felt since they were kids, but there's still something odd going on. And really, I think it's all about this new identity. We have to, over time, recognise that, and recognise it does take time, by the way. This does not happen overnight. And everything isn't automatically rainbows and bunnies, you know, in our outer world. even if we're feeling good within, we have to step into this new identity as someone who is sober. And it does take some time. So I think you just have to be kind to yourself over this. And you have to recognise not everyone is at the same stage that you're at. And it's tough. It's difficult. You are a little bit of an alien in their world. You know, someone who chooses not to drink poison, how bizarre. You know, I'm going to be playing you a clip from Jason Vale, you know, literally the guy who coined the phrase, alcohol is the only drug we have to justify not taking. How utterly bonkers. You've heard me talk in previous weeks, the interview with Susan Laurie. You know, alcohol does an incredible amount of harm. Alcohol is the number one most harmful drug when we take into account all kinds of other factors. We know that. And yet, you're seen as the one with several heads if you decide you're not drinking. So it's their problem. It's not our problem. But to start with, of course, particularly if you are someone who, you know, you like to fit in, you're a bit of a people pleaser. I mean, we all are to a certain extent. Nobody wants to feel like we're the ones that we're just odd. We're on the outside. So it's just all about rocking up with that authenticity. And just to give a few tips, I know I've given them before, my absolute top tip is prep ahead. So if you can, give those people you're going to be meeting a heads up. And you do not have to go into detail. In fact, I recommend you don't. It's just a one line. It's just, oh, by the way, I'm not drinking, so there'll be more for you. Oh, by the way, I'm not drinking, I'm doing a challenge, or I'm feeling much better without it, or I'm on medication. Who cares? Doesn't matter what you say. It's none of their business. Fib if you want to, tell the truth if you want to. But make it one line and then the important bit. But you don't have to worry about me because I've got some great alcohol-free beer, or because I'm really loving the kombucha or whatever. But that just kind of sets the scene. And yes, you might get an email back. What? Have you gone nuts? You know, or you might, but you just let it go. Literally, let it go. Let's face it, if you had a load of dental work, I can barely even say that, I've got so much going on at the moment, and you are on, you know, strong medication for a while, you wouldn't be drinking, right? It would be dangerous to drink and you wouldn't be drinking. And are people going to say, right, well then, do not come to my party. Do not meet me in the deli. Do not meet me in the pub because you are on medication and you cannot. Utterly bonkers. Of course you'd still go. Take away that emotional piece where if they're drinking, you ought to be drinking. Just give them one sentence, prep ahead, and then when you arrive at wherever it is, you know, literally just come in with your sentence, I'd love an alcohol-free drink. Yeah, I'm thirsty. I'll have a glass of water, please. Yeah, and whatever their answers or you know, head turns, just move on. Ask them something else about themselves. Change the subject. You get better at it. I promise you. That's what I said to the person who sent this email. It will come. I promise you. It does take a while. And what this email, what this person said at the end here, I'm still finding my footing. That's exactly it. You are. You really are. We're all toddlers when we start this. You know, we sort of get up, we fall down a little bit, we feel a bit fragile, but we get stronger. You do start to become this new person. And you know what? It's a person you like. We all come back to who we really are meant to be. But it takes a little while because we've had years and years and years of drowning everything out with toxic liquid. So, you know, it's bound to take some time, isn't it? But hang on in there. Seriously, hang on in there. It is so worth it. Well, you know that, don't you? So anyways, here's a few clips from guests that I've had in the past. And I really hope you enjoy some of these clips. Don't forget, you can let me know more of your favourites, perhaps from more recent podcasts. I'd love to know what you've enjoyed. And obviously, if there are guests that you'd like me to get on in the future, particularly if you can connect me, I'd be absolutely delighted to give that a go. If you're thinking of leaving us and you're not going to listen to the rest of these guests, then just a reminder that one of the things that really helps with that stepping into your new identity is being connected with other people who feel the same way, is sharing exactly this stuff with other people. So check out the Sober Club. It makes such a massive difference when you're connected with like-minded people who are going through the same kind of thing. Or maybe they're only on day one and you can support them. Or maybe they're on year 7 or 8 and they've got something new and big coming up in their life that has only come about because of sobriety, and you can cheer them on. That's what's so amazing about it. We become cheerleaders for each other. So do check it out if you haven't already. Enjoy the clips. But what you said at the beginning, you know, of this interview, where you said, you know, all addiction transcends knowledge and intelligence, you know, that that's yeah. such a powerful statement. You're so absolutely right, because, you know, I considered myself health and well-being guru, you know, across everything, me allegedly, but not the alcohol piece, because it's an illusion. We've all, you know, so many people have bought into this illusion, and I was skirting around this bloody great big elephant in the room. Would you agree that, I mean, obviously with Kick the Drink Easily, you know, what you've done in that book is explain the mindset. You've explained to us how we can get our brains thinking differently. And do you think that's the key?
I think beyond anything else, I think addiction lies in the mind, because it's not really a physical thing. And gambling teaches us this. So when somebody stops gambling and they're a severe gambler, they will suffer, quote unquote, the same physical withdrawal as somebody coming off of cigarettes or alcohol or any other drug.
Yeah.
And you know why that is? Because it's not a physical withdrawal. It's anxiety and fear.
Yeah, exactly.
So anxiety and fear create a physical response. Yeah. So if you believe that you cannot enjoy your life or cope with your life without what you deem to be your friend crutch or pleasure, fear will come into. And I always say to somebody, look, if you want to know if you're hooked on something or not, this is my definition, and I'm yet to be properly challenged on it, I would say, is it doesn't matter if it's sugar, alcohol, anything else. You ask yourself, if the thought of never doing it again fills me with an abnormal fear, well, then you're hooked. I'm sorry to say, that's how to realize.
Yeah.
So if, for example, somebody genuinely does have a couple of glasses of wine on a Saturday night, over dinner, this, that, and the other, and genuinely doesn't think about it during the week, and it genuinely doesn't bother them. Mm. The relationship they have with alcohol, I would say alcohol's never moved in and abused them, right? They've never moved in house. They live separately.
Yeah, they have an off switch.
It's like any relationship. Like alcohol lives down the road. You've got no real desire to see them. Like you barely know them. And actually they might nip over every now and then, you know, but they don't overstay their welcome. And there are some people that fall into that category, that if the thought of never doing it again fills you with fear, and they go, no, I'll just knock it on the head. Right. Mm. Now they are few and far between. You and I both know that, right? That's not the majority of people. Right. But they do exist, in the same way there are some people that have the odd cigarette. I don't know how they do that. I mean, God, if I had to have another cigarette, I'd probably be on 40, 60 a day again. Right. Mm. Cause this thing just gets into you, not because it transcends logic and intelligence. It's fear. If I said to somebody who's covered in psoriasis, and they've got, they're overweight, and they've got eczema, and they've got asthma, and they've got all these ailments. And I said, well, I found the problem is you've got to stop eating blueberries, right? Well, nobody would create fear. And blueberries are nice. Have you had to find somebody who doesn't like a blueberry? So it's not a case of liking something. It's not okay. What it comes down to is something emotive.
Yeah,
so exactly. normal food, as in that doesn't contain refined fat, salt, sugar. Because people say, oh, I eat as a response to emotion. And I say, no, you don't. And they argue with me. And I go, well, you don't. You eat certain things as a response to emotion, as we all do. So, because I've never heard anybody go, I've had a really bad day, I'm really pissed off, I need a grape. I've never heard it in my life. It doesn't happen.
And there's no such broccoli.
Well, there's no such thing as Broccoli Anonymous. There's no such thing as Banana Anonymous. Because they don't exist. So therefore, we've got to really look at this and go, well, is it a personality-driven trait then? Or is it a substance? Well, it's a combination of the two, but it's not personality-driven, it's substance-driven. Then the personality comes into it. But it has to be the substance first. We will all sink in the quicksand at different rates. But ask yourself the question, when it comes to alcohol or anything else, if the thought of never doing it again, oh, you future pace. Oh, but what about weddings? What about christenings? What about this? Oh my God. And you literally start to freaking shake. Well, then clearly you're hooked.
As you know, I was very proud to release my own book, Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. I think it's been out almost a year, actually, amazingly. It's never a great time to bring out a book in lockdown, but, you know, it's done all right. And of course, it's still selling. So if you haven't got it yet, there's my little plug, including the audio book, which is out now. And of course, I'm eternally grateful to Denise Welsh. If you're not in the UK, you don't know who Denise Welsh is. She's a hugely successful actress, and she's been in many very famous things in the UK, not least some soap operas. She's a real character, and she's been so open about her own struggles with mental health issues, with depression, and her own issues with alcohol. She's really helped a huge number of people, I think, by just bringing this stuff out into the mainstream. So Denise wrote the foreword for my book, and I'm hugely grateful to her for that. But I've also had her as a podcast guest. So here's a clip with Denise.
I just wonder whether you can give us any, and this sounds very flippant in the light of everything we've spoken about, but what would you suggest that people do who do suffer from depression on whatever level? You know, are there some things that you would recommend people putting in place? You know, what are the strategies that everyone can do? I mean, does walking in nature make a difference? Does the right nutrition make a difference? What about exercise? Are there any of those lifestyle things that can help?
All of those things are things that we should all be doing.
Yeah.
And those things help, I think, how long the unwelcome visitor stays.
Okay.
However, once depression is in, there is no amount of talking, walking, eating, that's gone. What you have to do is try to, my book is called Depression and How I Survive It. And it's about surviving and in surviving the visits and loving the times in between. So in the good times in between, try to eat well and try to get, even if it's just a walk, you know, and if you are a sufferer, try to take alcohol out of your life you can. It is the most wonderful life without alcohol.
Yeah.
I know I had Lincoln, and I do know that is easier with somebody. The other thing is, when I was first poorly, there was nothing, as I say, except paragraphs like this in magazines. Now we have Google, and we can Google depression help, and there will be a group, a support group, a community, a person, because I know that getting professional help sometimes in the mental health system is hard, and now harder, but there will be somebody who will listen. And if you find that your GP or your family don't, look further afield.
Yeah.
Please don't think that you have anything to do with getting this illness. It's an illness like any other, and the unwelcome visitor always leaves.
The lovely Denise Welsh. And thanks again, Denise, for doing the foreword for the book. And I'm sure you've heard me mention so many times how much I love my Quitlet and how, you know, in the early stages, it was a lifeline for me. It really was, immersing myself in that, you know, in that stuff in the books that just gave me optimism, that just gave me hope. The memoirs, which were sometimes hard hitting, and then, you know, just being able to sort of catch sight of that better life. And I think that's what it's all about, really. I was mentioning that I'm in the middle of just started an accountability program with a group of clients, and really, so much of the conversation that we've been having is around how do we hold on to the commitment that we've made. And, you know, partly it's the logic. So partly it's knowing that alcohol is really bad for you. You know, we need to really know it in our gut. This is where, you know, Annie Grace and William Porter are so brilliant, because they've really nailed that piece. And William's written something in my book as well. So, you know, they've really nailed that logic piece, that why alcohol is so unbelievably bad for us. Let's not sugarcoat it ever. So that piece is really good for our commitment. But of course, perhaps even more important than that is the emotional side of it. So it's the motivation, because ultimately, if we don't feel that we're doing the right thing for us at the time, we'll just, you know, cave and take a drink, irrespective of what we know logically, because that, you know, that phrase, emotions, not logic, will inspire action. So we have to get the logic and the emotional piece working together. And one of the best ways to do that is to just have a vision, have a goal, have something you're aiming towards, and really be able to see yourself in this fabulous new way. How amazing is your life going to be, you know, when you've ditched the booze? And one of the members of our group has got herself a little sticker chart, and she's planning all of these rewards, healthy self-care treats for herself, you know, when she reaches certain milestones, and really being able to visualize what life's going to be like as you move forward. Because, you know, there sure has been some amazing transformations. I've mentioned it so many times, but in the Sober Club, there's just been people who have done things they never would have even dream that they could do. You know, it was a distant dream that they were going to start a business or travel or move to a different part of the country or move abroad or whatever it is, you know, in their life. Just stuff that they didn't have the mojo, didn't have the energy to do before. But once you've ditched the booze, it frees up time and it makes you feel so much clearer. And, you know, it's that piece of starting to like yourself a little bit that makes, you know, all the difference in the world. Anyways, where was I? Yeah. So, as I say, Quit Lit Books made a massive difference to me. After Claire Pooley's book, the next one I read was The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober by Catherine Gray. I mean, worth it for the name alone. Man, what a title. And I really have come to discover, you know, the unexpected joy. I really have. I don't think I ever used to appreciate little things before. So The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober was just a game changer, I think, for so many people. And then I read Catherine's next book, The Unexpected Joy of Being Single, and then The Unexpected Joy of the Ordinary, all fantastic book. She's just such a beautiful writer. So I was really chuffed to get to interview Catherine.
That's, of course, not to say that we don't get the munchies for sugar in the early weeks, some of us, and, you know, we do start doing other things, but that doesn't mean that that's going to happen forever. I think it's a case of, you know, as you said, I love the way you described the fact that you're a toddler in those early weeks and months. You really are finding your feet. And of course you're going to have extra time on your hands and not know what to do with yourself. And your chemical, you know, the neurochemicals are all over the shop. So of course you're going to reach for sugar or whatever. But over time, and that's what's so lovely about, you know, your book, you're throwing this forward in time. So you're being really realistic about how things pan out when you feel just so much more stable. I think that's a word that so often comes up for me. I'm so much more stable than I was.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel safe. That was a key theme in the book, that I finally feel safe within myself and in my relationships and from alcohol. And it's just such a luxurious place to find myself.
Yeah, so there's a little section on boundaries, isn't there, which is great.
Yeah, boundaries. Oh my gosh. I don't know what your relationship's been like with boundaries.
Oh, terrible in the past. Terrible.
Yeah. I literally only learned how to do them about 2 years ago.
I actually thought that setting boundaries meant you were just a really arsy person.
Yeah, me too. I would bitch about people who set boundaries with me. I'd be like, how dare they say no to my unreasonable request? How dare they not reply to my unsolicited email asking them for a favour? It just is. But the thing is, it's very common that people who don't have boundaries themselves. So I was very much the type that would pretty much do anything you asked me to do. If you asked me to do it, they are the people who expect other people to say yes to everything. Mm. So it's the boundaryless who get irate when we set boundaries with them. Yeah. So I think that's important to remember, to have that compassion, because it's just that they're not there yet and they don't know what boundaries are and they don't know that they're healthy. Yeah. Now, when people say no to me, I literally feel like high-fiving them.
Yes.
Like, nice boundaries. And you can tell when somebody is a healthy, when they've really gone through this process and that they're healthy and secure and in all of this too, because they will respond to your no with, oh my God, absolutely no worries, you know.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd ask, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know that it's not damaged the relationship and they're not going away to have a bitching session about you because you said no.
Yeah. Totally.
But it's so important in recovery or whatever you call it, in, you know, in staying sober, I found, because if you don't set boundaries, you become cannibalized with resentment over time, because your energy and your day and your effort and your work schedule is not your own. You just give it to other people all the time. And so then you don't have enough time for yourself or time to rest or money or, you know, whatever it is that you need, because you're just giving it away all the time.
Yeah.
And obviously give away some of it, give away maybe half of it, you know, but keep enough for yourself.
Well, self-care is just the thing we have to learn, you know. I mean, I had no idea what it meant till I got sober.
Yeah.
you know, self-care is like those, you know, rich women that go to spas and lunch the whole time. I had no idea what it meant. For me, my self-care was a glass of wine. So I had no idea what it really meant.
Oh, my God. I really identify with that. And I wonder if it's something that the younger generations are just much more au fait with. They've often been parented in a way where a no isn't the worst thing you can say to a parent.
Sure. I think that's true.
Yeah, so I was definitely parented in the way that you did not say no to superior, you know, people in your family, and you did not say no to work colleagues either, because I was in a very competitive industry like you. Mm. So you just had to say yes to everything to A, get people to like you, continue to like you, and B, get ahead.
Yeah.
And so I just carried this one way too far, and it's something that I still struggle with to this day.
Thank you, Catherine. And then bringing us sort of fairly up to date to an interview that I did not too long ago is with Dr. David Hamilton. Now, I've known David for so many years. He's a fellow Hay House author. I've heard him speak. We've been on the same bill a lot of times. I love what he does. And this new book, particularly, Why Woo Woo Works, it's just fabulous that it actually, you know, reveals the scientific piece, because it is really easy to just dismiss anything that you don't quite understand as woo woo and nonsense. But usually it's exactly that. It's just because you don't really understand it. And as most of you know, in the Sober Club, I love introducing a bit of woo-woo. We do have all the kind of practical stuff in there. There's huge amounts of stuff around nutrition and fitness and mindset and meditation and well-being, and obviously the nitty-gritty of actually ditching the booze and staying sober and finding your purpose and being creative. But then there's also the what some people would call totally woo-woo stuff. I bring in an angel expert, Beverly Densham, who's going to be a guest on the podcast, by the way. Joe Soli has done stuff on numerology for us. You know, I had Yakov Darling Khan doing a fabulous movement meditation. We've got lots of amazing meditations. I'm going to be bringing in someone to talk about crystals. So yeah, you know, I'm fully immersed in the woo-woo, but it's just great to have David explain a bit of this to us. So I thought you might enjoy hearing another clip.
So before we get into the book, just give us a little bit of your kind of potted history for anyone who hasn't come across your work.
Yeah, I worked as an R&D scientist in a really big pharmaceutical company, really building drugs for heart disease and cancer. I say building drugs, I was what you call an organic chemist, which is like an adult who plays Lego. But instead of using, you know, plastic building blocks to assemble a variety of shapes, you use atomic building blocks. But the idea is the same. It's like Lego. And I used to literally build atomically what became, you know, heart medicines and cancer medicines. But I really was more intrigued by the placebo effect. And I started to study it in my spare time when I worked in the industry. At the time, you know, this was, you know, I started working in the pharmaceutical industry in the late 90s, and the mind-body connection was not understood very well at all.
Yeah.
And so when I started to suggest to my colleagues that there could be some mind-body connection that explained the placebo effect, you know, they used to laugh, call it quackery. I mean, not unkindly, we were all just friends, you know, but you know the way friends banter, oh, it's all quackery, and all that kind of stuff, because nobody understood it. So we just assumed, and this is actually a common theme through all perception of woo-woo. We just assumed, you know, that, or my colleagues assumed that people who responded to placebo were just going to get better anyway. I began to research it and realized that there was actually something going on. And it turned out even then there was lots of available science, but we just didn't know that. And I find, and one of my motivations behind the book is, so many people refer to things as woo-woo, sometimes even pseudoscience, not because they're speaking from a position of knowledge and authority and they can rightly say, oh, that's woo-woo or pseudoscience. Most of the time you find it's because they're not experts at all. And actually really don't know that there is available science and there is available philosophical thought. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to the best of my ability, pull a lot of that together and at least give people who do practice these kind of things a wee bit of, you know, backing to say there is a lot of stuff there. And for people who are skeptical, to say, look, before you be skeptical, at least look at some of the data and you'll see that maybe, you know, we shouldn't really be calling these things woo-woo after all, because the definition of woo-woo really is unconventional beliefs regarding having little or no scientific
data. Exactly. It's very derogatory, isn't it?
It's very, very derogatory.
Yeah. And I mean, we're all so used to being, you know, sort of laughed at and being called woo-woo. But as you say, there is so much science, you know, behind all of this stuff. So where did you kind of start when you were thinking about the book, about what you would include about, you know, I mean, were there aspects of this that came as a bit of a surprise to you when you actually did a bit more digging deep?
Yeah. I mean, I started in what I call the lower end of woo woo.
Yeah.
From the lower end to the high end.
You know, go on then. Give us a benchmark.
You know,
because I'm probably at all ends.
Yeah, well, me too, actually.
Or at least I have been there over the years. Let's put it that way.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. I kind of flip between all three. But, you know, the lower end, I call it things like, you know, the impact of thoughts and emotions on your brain, on your physiology, you know, placebo effect, meditation, even things like how emotions can, you know, trapped emotion can have an impact by almost storing up charge in the nervous system in the context of trauma, kind of lower end of woo-woo, meaning at least some people are aware that there probably is research, even though most people don't know about it. So I gathered a lot of that. Then moving into things like Reiki and crystals, I call the kind of mid-range and the idea that perception shapes reality and show that there's a heck of a lot of science available, either trial data or at least show why these things might work for us. Moving into the higher end, you know, like psi, ESP, telepathy, prayer, all that kind of stuff, even law of attraction, and sketched a whole basis of science. To answer your question, what was most surprising to me was just how much science there was that could explain how crystals work.
Ah, interesting.
That was, for me, the most surprising. In fact, so much so that it's the biggest chapter. I had to take out about three. It was too long, and you can't have a chapter that takes longer than an hour to read.
Right.
For audiobooks, otherwise Audible and other things, they just snap it over into two chapters and it spoils the flow.
Right.
So you're really limited in the number of words. So I literally had to chop off.
So give us a bit more detail on that then. What should we be looking for crystals? What can we all benefit from with crystals?
In terms of crystals, there's actually three different ways. First of all, there isn't any scientific studies on crystals because, to be honest, most academics wouldn't touch the subject anyway. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there. They just probably wouldn't touch it for the sake of their careers. I know what that's like. There's certain subject I would have avoided in the past as well for the sake of people, you know, almost ridiculing. But what there is, though, is lots of research that would suggest why they might work for us. Let me give you an example of where I'm coming from. So in the Buddhist teaching of Dzogchen, you know, D-Z-O-G-C-H-E-N, Dzogchen, they often use a clear crystal. The teachers use a clear crystal.
Like a quartz crystal.
Like a clear quartz. Yeah. So this is a citrine I've got here, but a clear quartz. Now, what the clarity of the quartz does is it serves as what's called a mental representation. Now, in cognitive psychology, that's a really well-known area of research. So by mental representation, what I mean is that the teachers of Dzogchen use that as a focal point for the practitioners, and it gives them something to focus on because the clarity of the crystal represents to them the clarity and the clear state of mind and being that one wishes to attain.
Yeah,
so it becomes a focal point, something to focus on. So by holding the crystal, even by having it in your visual field, and you see the clarity of it, your mind becomes less muddled and fuddy because you keep looking at it and seeing it, and that reminds you, I have to achieve a clear state of being. So it's like a constant reminder. Now, common sense tells you having a constant reminder of a goal is going to help you achieve that goal.
So don't forget to let me know what your favourite podcasts have been, perhaps in the last few months, and we'll run a few more reminders for you. I think it's great to just go back and have another listen to some of the stuff you've enjoyed in the past. And just a reminder that we do have Sober by the Sea. I can't actually remember if it's sold out, might be sold out, but go to events at thesoberclub.com. We also have a Champneys retreat coming up at the end of September 30th to the 1st. at Champneys in Tring in Hertfordshire. We are planning a Family Constellations workshop. Go to thesoberclub.com, click on events, and that will be there ASAP. You know how you can get hold of me. Just message me. I can't always promise I'll reply to everything, but I'll do my best. You'll find me on social media, follow me on Instagram and, you know, Twitter and everything, at Janie Lee Grace. I'm very easy to find there. Happy, Healthy, Sober on Facebook. And yeah, if you're doing this hard thing, then you have all of my love and respect and encouragement, and I'll hold that vision for you. This is so worth doing. See you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.